another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org, and with me I have my co-host and friend, Bob Scott, former co-founder of the Kansas City Fellowship and author of three books. The latest is Some Said They Blundered, Breaking My Decades of Silence on Mike Bickle, the Kansas City Prophets, and the International House of Prayer. Bob, it's good to be back. This podcast will probably come out, late February, March. You and I have not talked in a very long while because of sickness and business and all kinds of different things, but we I packed the podcast lineup full of podcasts to kind of keep it going until we could connect again. But interestingly, in that time that we were waiting, I had people reach out and contact me for exactly what you wanted to talk about today. And that's the question, the burning question that everybody has. How did this mess come to be? Show me the map. Show me. And the funny part of it is, well, I mentioned this to you offline before we started recording. I have different channels of podcasts, all combined into the William Branham Historical Research, but they're different series. And if you go to the playlists on YouTube, you can see all the series. I'll eventually be breaking this out even further, but Charles and I covered this quite extensively, and I'll throw it up on the screen a few times as we're talking today, but we made this flow chart. Charles mostly made this flow chart that shows a diagram of how all of these movements just kind of developed from each other and cross-pollinated, etc. And keep in mind, as you're looking at this on, if you're watching the YouTube and you can see it on the screen, keep in mind when you see one of these nodes that's connected to another node, you might have 50 to 100 to 1,000 different other influences and nodes connecting them. So it is a spaghetti mess of influence. Mm. But I wanted to dive deeper with you, and so did the listeners. How does that relate back to IHOPKC? How does it relate back to the Kansas City Fellowship? And who better to ask than Bob Scott?
Well, John, here's my big question. Who's your daddy?
If you're talking about the religious world, it's so hard to tell, man.
Right. And I know I'm being funny here, but it's a very valid question. And I think you know, as a historian, that events in history just don't happen. They actually happen via relationships. Like, you can actually connect the dots, right? All of human history moves by people in proximity to each other. It's very rare that two things happen that are disconnected. Most of the time, it's connected. And what's even more interesting is how these events happen in very small subcultures, right? And, you know, somebody's brother, cousin, you know, connection. You see this all through your life, right? You know, it's like my kids now, they have this phrase, hook me up, right? Hook me up, Dad. Hook me up. And who are they wanting to be hook me up with? Well, somebody that I'm related to, right? Somebody that's in my small little subculture, right? Because that's how things move. So one of the questions that I've been asking for years is like, how did we get here, right? I think I've mentioned this in previous broadcasts, but it wasn't until the mid-1980s that I even began to connect the dots that somehow what we were doing in Kansas City was related to Pentecostalism and potentially William Branham, who I'd never heard of in my life. I'm a Catholic kid from Milwaukee, right? I have, you know, I don't know anything about Protestantism. And then even when I ended up committing my life to God, it was through mainline evangelicalism, who didn't believe in the gifts of the Holy Spirit. So in the 1980s, when a lot of things were happening, I had no context, right? And so at first, I was completely kind of in awe. And they say on your heels, right? It's like your this thing is happening to you, and you're not even really sure what's going on, and you're trying to adapt. And then as you get more and more familiar, then my little brain starts going into analytical mode, going, "Well, what is this? I'm like, where did it come from? How did we get here, right?" And for those that don't know my story, I mean, It's 1983, in March of 1983, and this fat little roly-poly silver-haired guy shows up at our church with all these weird giftings, right? Or, you know, claiming to see things and hear things from God. And what was even crazier, some of it was actually true. Like there were some things that he was saying that were real, and then some stuff was so Star Wars and out there, it was like, well, how do I even reconcile? And who is this guy? Where did he come from? Like, you know what I mean? It's like one of those movies when the stranger comes into town, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, who is this masked man, right? And of course, that was Bob Jones, you know. And then a few years later, I ended up meeting John Paul Jackson and then Paul Kane, and then three of them are all of a sudden in our church. Who can deal with that, right? Yeah. It was like having three nuclear reactors all in your church at the same time. Like, it's like there was nothing normal. Like, normal was not a word in our vocabulary, because it was just, you know, kind of wild. But it took me a long time to figure it out. And even now, I'm still kind of piecing it together. So that was one of my questions for you. Because there's a lot going on right now, right? There's a lot of, you know, we've been through a couple years of controversy and guys getting called out, and, you know, it's even made that question more pertinent to me.
Yeah, it's such a mess. You know, so I'm going to take it to the very, very high level and take it down, because I don't think, unless you have a mindset that is thinking like a historian, you don't even have to be a historian, but you have to think like one, you really don't understand how all of this cross-pollination of ideas works. And you can tell it in the comment feeds. In fact, I just had one last night. This guy says, you can't talk about so-and-so and connect them to so-and-so. It just happened to be IHOP KC, because they have no connection whatsoever. But you don't understand this cross-pollination of ideas. It grows far beyond what you can fathom. And I'll give a high-level example. So we are recording this on Super Bowl Sunday. And for all of you IHOP KC people, sadly, the Chiefs didn't win, so the world is not going to end.
Yeah.
This will come out much later, obviously.
Next year. But
yeah, next year the Chiefs will win. I'm a Chiefs fan, so I'm sad. But anyway, I went to the grocery store because I'm having some people over to watch the Super Bowl. And I go to look at the pork. I want to buy some sausage because I've got a smoker. I'm going to smoke some stuff. So I look and
you smoke some stuff, John.
I smoke some stuff and get really happy. Okay. So I'm looking at all the sausages, and there's all these different brands and flavors and mixtures and marinated and not marinated. Wow. There's all kinds of stuff, right? Well, say I chose a particular brand, I'm not going to tell you, particular sausage, and I have my special recipe that I make stuff with. So somebody comes over to my house and they eat the stuff and they say, man, this is really good. What is it? And I tell them what sausage I put in it. Well, they go home, they start making it, and they decide, well, hey, that was really good. I'll bet that would be good on taco meat. So they make it on their taco meat. Somebody else comes over, they eat the taco meat. Right. Man, that sauce is phenomenal. What is this that you put on the taco meat? Well, that would be good on spaghetti. And so they go put it on spaghetti. Well, long story short, you can go down that chain 3 or 4 miles, right? And somebody comes and they realize that somebody's eating spaghetti with this particular sausage and say, well, that's the best sausage for spaghetti. It might not actually be the best sausage for spaghetti, but it went down that trail because of cross-pollination, right? Well, that is what happened. You mentioned Pentecostalism and IHOP KC. That's largely what happened. Another example. So Ern Baxter, we've talked about before, William Branham's campaign manager, and early on it was the Baxter Branham campaigns. Mm-hmm. He and four others formed the Shepherding Movement, which was sort of a hierarchical destructive cult that prototyped the New Apostolic Reformation. Mm-hmm. I talked about them one time, and I talked about in the same podcast, talked about Youth with a Mission. And people send me the mail, you can't talk about shepherding and youth with a mission. These are so far disconnected. But yet, I have newspaper articles where Ern Baxter is going to bases of YWAM in other countries.
Mm. Right.
What's happening there, it's cross-pollination. It doesn't mean that they adopt the shepherding or whatever, but you get these ideas that just kind of cascade down and down through time. And the truth of the matter is, and we can talk about the flow chart more, we can go deeper, but the truth of the matter is this. William Branham and Gordon Lindsay together formed what became one of the greatest pyramid schemes of all time, greater than any of the pyramid schemes that you look at for money. They're breaking in I can't tell you how many millions of dollars, mm-hmm. right? But it was a platform of a pyramid scheme where they could platform these ministers. The ministers could easily get a following, tent campaigns, etc., combined with a full gospel businessman to help fund these things, mm-hmm. right? Joel Osteen's a good example. His church would not exist had the full gospel businessman not funded his father, John Osteen. His father, mm-hmm. John Osteen, was in this thing, connected directly to Branham. In fact, I can put him at, actually, I can put him at some of the Branham revivals, at least one. So mm-hmm. you've got this big conglomeration of people who are being platformed. Well, in that platform, there are strong disagreements, but they're cross-pollinating. So some mm-hmm. of these ideas continue to evolve. And over time, what you get is it's like a Heinz 57 religion. You don't know what you're mm-hmm. going to get until you open it mm-hmm. up and look.
Well, it's hard for me, to be quite frank, is a lot of what's happening now. You know, you've seen a lot of these guys supposedly getting exposed. And to your point, this goes all the way back to the 1980s, right? You know, as you and I've talked, I've always had this weird knower about something's wrong at the foundation or at the root. And then my brain tends to extrapolate out, well, if this thing remains here, then this is where we're going to end up, right? And my brain tends to just automatically go there. And so in the 80s, you know, Mike Bickle and I got sideways about the whole prophetic thing because he and I had very different ideas about what was prophetic. And now in hindsight, as I look back, as Mike was wanting to continue on with the Pentecostal sort of latter rain model of what is prophetic, and my heart was longing for something much different, moving away from the sort of media, sensational, you know, individual prophet thing to more of a community of prophetic people that humble themselves to be, right? And we got sideways with that. Well, what's sad is all the guys right now, the Bob Hartleys, the Shambles, the guys right now that are just getting annihilated publicly, I warned them all back in the 1980s, do not model yourself after Bob Jones, right? And I know at the time I probably sounded like a complete idiot, right? Because you're sitting there looking at this guy, Bob Jones, who's basically a hillbilly from Arkansas, who's uneducated, who now is on a stage, has this massive following, everybody loves him, and you're telling two young guys who desperately want to be seen and heard and feel like they got their calling to don't do this, you know, right? It's and because he is what they want to be, right? And you're trying to explain to them, no, 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 this thing's going to crash and burn, right? This isn't really what's in God's heart for what is prophetic, right? It's like this thing got off the rails decades ago. And this is why I want to have this conversation with you, because what happened was, is it started so many years ago, right? And it's like that whole thing where you can be off by 1 degree, right? But then as you get farther and farther and farther out, you're like, you know, it's like trying to land a rocket ship on the moon, right? If you're just a degree off, by the time you get to the moon, you're not even near the moon, right? I mean, it's so precise. And I remember thinking this back then. It's like, if you guys model yourself after this, you're going to end up shipwrecking. And of course, like Mike, they all just laughed at me and thought I was being a pessimist or I was being negative or I was, you know, I didn't see it or whatever. And I said, no, you don't understand what's, you know, what's underneath this isn't right, right? It's got so much mixture and human mess in this that it's not going to last. It's not pure. It's not even holy or whatever, right? So it's hard for me. It's like, here I am, what is it, 40 years later, and everything that I warned people about in the 1980s with people that I loved, and now I'm watching them all shipwrecked, you know? And it's kind of like you're just sitting there, you know, looking at these wrecks on the ocean, you know, on the shoreline, and you're just going, God, gosh, this shouldn't have been this. But it's because they were sucked into something, you know, again, who's your daddy? Well, their daddy was Bob Jones, right? Not necessarily as much Paul Kane. Paul Kane was a loner, right? Paul Kane was like a loner. Like he was the gunslinger, you know, like we were talking about that guy, that mystery guy that came into town, right? Bob Jones loved to be the center of attention. So he always had this group of people around him, right? He liked being Papa. Paul Kane was not a natural father, right? It wasn't that. So Bob Jones became that model, right? But they've all ended up where Bob was, right? All the same things that Bob ended up shipwrecking over, they shipwrecked over. And so then I asked myself, well, then where did Bob Jones get his worldview and his perspective about prophetic, right? Well, now we're in your world because it was William Branham. It was Latter Rain, right? And I didn't understand any of this until I read David Harrell's book, All Things Are Possible. And David Harrell was the one that connected the dots for me. That was my aha moment where I went, oh. So, because, I mean, this is going to sound funny to all you guys that come from the Latter Rain movement, but it was like, I thought we were being original. See, this was the kind of the humiliating moment, right? Because I'm thinking me and Mike are on the cutting edge. Like, we're on the cutting edge of the new thing God's doing, only to discover in the middle of it, no, you're just another version of an old thing.
Well, and that continues to happen. There's this ebb and flow that happens. See, here's the other thing. Like it or not, this type of religion trains people into a very black or white mentality. You're either with us, you're against us, you're for with us, or you are one of the other guys, right? Mm-hmm. It's us versus them. Well, when you're in that type of mentality, you think of history as static. So when I was a kid, I was a Mets fan, and mm-hmm. I was a Chiefs fan. Loved the Mets, and later on, I started liking the Braves. I don't mm-hmm. know why. I can't tell you why, but I became a Braves fan. And then when this big strike happened in the 90s, I hated baseball entirely because I became disillusioned. But now, if I'm going to watch a game, I'll watch a Braves game. Mm-hmm. If you're talking to somebody and they talk about me and my baseball, they would say John's a Braves fan. He's always been a Braves fan. That's kind of the mentality you take. You don't realize that people change and grow, and that happens mm-hmm. not just with people, but also organizations of people. So whenever I first started doing this, I was working with a guy, and we were deeply studying the connection between Branhamism and Jim Jones and People's Temple.
But Jones was a disciple of Branham, not the other way around, right?
Correct. Correct.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
because Jones and Paul Kane were contemporaries.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. That's
exactly.
Yeah. Because I remember, actually, funny enough, I remember when that whole thing happened, and Paul just heartbroken that Jim went off. Because I know that guy so well. Like, you know, like, wow, this is really scary. You know, he was really freaked out by that.
Yeah. And so this researcher that I'm working with, he had reached out when he found out that Jim Jones was ordained by the Assemblies of God. He reached out to the Assemblies, mm-hmm. and they explained to him that no, he was ordained by the Independent Assemblies of God, and they had no connection to this thing that Jones was in, the Latter Rain, Branhamism, etc., right. Which isn't quite true, and I didn't get their exact letter, so I don't know exactly how they responded. But if you contact them and ask them, let's say, no, we in 1948 or 49, we put a stop to it. We're against mm-hmm. this Latter Rain. And so therefore, in the future, everybody who contacts them, they're going to say, well, they're not connected at all. Mm-hmm. But if not for the Assemblies of God, the Latter Rain would not have exploded as it did. It was mostly throughout the Assemblies and Pentecostal churches that this thing exploded. Mm-hmm. And then even in the aftermath, after they shut it down, you had wide swaths of the Assemblies of God ministers who didn't know they were supposed to shut it down.
Right.
And some who just bucked the system and said, heck no, we're not going to do this. There's too much money coming in.
So my question then is, who's William Branham's daddy? Now, I have listened to some of your stuff in the past, and you talk about Roy Davis, and I think you've talked about F.F. Bosworth, right? But were they the two most influential people on William's concept of ministry, his concept of being prophetic, all of that? Because I know that he went and did his own thing, but originally somebody formed in his brain this idea of what, how things should be.
So in this flow chart that I gave you a copy and I'm putting it on the screen.
Yeah, I'm looking at it.
Look at it. So in this, as I said, each one of those nodes has so many different smaller categories and sub diagrams that we could go into. But there's a lot that people don't understand. I have mentioned Bosworth. I have mentioned Davis. Mm-hmm. But let's explode that just a bit more, because I think it'll make sense whenever you think about...
Well, because I'm thinking relationally, right? In other words, there was some person that influenced him, right? Because it's all, you know, that's what we're talking about, genealogy, right? It's always, who's your dad? Like, who was your spiritual father? Who was your guy that was your, you know, was your big influence? And that's where I'm curious with him. It's like, well, who influenced him?
Yeah, absolutely. So let's break it out just a little bit.
Okay.
Because I think this will make more sense whenever I explode that portion of it. So in the beginning, there are two main cults that I want to talk about, and I've talked about them often. Frank Sanford's cult in Maine and John Dowie's cult in Zion City, Illinois.
John Alexander Dowie, yep.
Absolutely. So those were probably the two biggest influences on Pentecostalism. However, there were, I don't know, hundreds of different holiness groups that had an influence on Pentecostalism. But Charles Fox Parham visited those two specifically right before he founded his compound, or his this big castle. It's a weird story, in Topeka, Kansas. Mm-hmm. He goes to visit. How are these two guys doing what they're doing? Dowie has just made, I think it's $15 million, which is like half $1 billion in today's money. Frank Sanford is the one I want to focus on just a bit, though, because Sanford had this massive Bible college that was big enough to attract Charles Fox Parham to come see it. And this was apparently a world famous kind of thing, but like most of the cult research that we've done so far, these cults kind of cut off the thing, the bad apples, and say, no, we have no connection to this. So he's kind of faded off into this obscure thing that we don't even yet know how much impact he had, right?
Got it.
But he impacted Charles Fox Parham. Parham is influenced, obviously, by Zion City, but there's another connection. He, whenever Dowie lost his mental faculties, he's got this massive empire, great wealth. Chicago suddenly flooded with people wanting to take over that empire. Parham is one of them. Mm. And Parham had one of the, out of all of the other sub cults that were kind of brewing there, he had one of the more influential ones, because F.F. Bosworth joined into it, John G. Lake joined into it, Tom Hesmelhouch, different ones that became pillars of Pentecostalism. They became what was known as the Parhamite sect, and they were doing the early forms of deliverance ministry, and actually, unfortunately, killing people in that deliverance ministry. You can look up Parhamite murders. So you have that subsect that's forming. Then if you branch out just a little bit from that, explode that just a little bit, Charles Fox Parham gets in trouble, and you can look up the things that he did, which was horrific. Almost goes to jail for something that he did with not just one, but multiple children. Mm-hmm. When he comes out, he avoids the whole Parhamite murders thing, because he's not even in the city when it happens. Well, these people just scatter. Mm-hmm. And one of the places that they scattered to was the Assemblies of God when it was formed. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know this, John Lake and F.F. Bosworth were in the initial meeting that formed the Assemblies of God.
Wow.
They were also connected, and Parham directly was connected to Amy Simple McPherson's Foursquare.
Oh, yeah, I was going to bring her up, too, because, you know, where my brain is it's this whole ministry model is where I'm going, right? Because the guys that are in trouble now, their ministry model, like how they held themselves, how they viewed themselves, how they built their ministry, you know, was Bob Jones. Bob Jones is William Branham. William Branham, somebody was a model to him, right? It's like you don't start out as a kid and know you're looking at somebody and go, I want to be that. And I was like, well, is it Amy Simple McPherson? She was so dramatic, and, you know, the radio thing, and you know what I mean? And what's fascinating to me, just sidebar here, I'm ADDing here, is one of the things that people tend to discount is what was happening in the culture at the time. Like, they see these religious figures as sort of separate from everything else going on. Well, Amy Simple McPherson is in Hollywood, right? She is, her whole stick, if you want to call it that, is all modeled on her being, you know, an actress, a movie star. Like she's, it's like she's just doing a Christian version of movie stardom, right? You know, Sister Amy and all of that, right? You go back to, and I know this because my family's from Chicago, but the, one of the guys that completely transformed Chicago was Cyrus McCormick, who invented the Reaper, who moved from North Carolina to Chicago to start International Harvester, right? So suddenly Chicago goes from this way out in the frontier to suddenly this, you know, they're selling farm implements, right? And all, it's like Chicago's, you know, all the meat coming from Texas is coming to Kansas City, which is then being put on trains to Chicago to armor, right? It's like this big agricultural hub. And so Dowie's right there at the same time that Chicago's exploding, right? And so it's like, it's all this stuff doesn't happen because it's just them, right? There's bigger things going on around them that sort of make them who they are. But I just always wondered, it's like, wow, like Branham, who did he model himself after? Like he looked at somebody and went, I want to be that, right? Because if you look all the way through, that's what everybody else does, right? They see somebody, you know, but it's the same thing in music. Like I was listening to somebody the other day, a comedian who was interviewing Carol Burnett. And she goes, I saw you on TV. And when I saw you on TV, I went, that's what I want to do. You know? And it's the same thing in the ministry world. It's like, you know what I mean? It's like somebody he saw and went, that's me.
So one of the things that was really hard for me to understand, and much like you're describing, I took a linear path. Branham learned from somebody. Who was that somebody?
Yeah.
And I tried to find him. And I went, that's actually what led me to Dowie. I went the Bosworth path. You can study, Bosworth was in several of the revivals. They've got photographs together. Bosworth is mentoring Branham in ministry. But what I learned was it's not that simple.
Really?
And that's why we actually started this diagram, and one of the troubles we had in actually making it. So you mentioned that the surrounding, the culture has an impact. Well, think about this. In the early years, right before all of this is starting to come to a head, you had also the fundamentalist movement, which was coming to a head. And let's just take a step back. Let me explode another one of these nodes, and I think you'll get what I'm trying to say here. One of the things that happened right after the Scopes monkey trial.
Oh, right, with Jennings.
When Jennings died, he was dubbed a hero of the Christian faith, defender of the Christian faith. When he died, there was an organization created by Gerald Burton Winrod called the Defenders of the Christian Faith. He joined forces with several people that had an impact on Branham's life and the NAR. Charles Fuller was one of the key people traveling with Gerald Burton Winrod. Another man by the name, the one that wrote Branham's Only Believe song, Paul Rader. Paul Rader was in this thing, and you can find photographs of these guys online. The message that they were sending and the prophecies that they were including in the ministry, I can find trace elements of those prophecies in Branham's sermons. In fact, Winrod was almost arrested in the Great Sedition Trial of 44 for certain things he was saying, and Branham mentions that he was also almost arrested. So you can connect the dots if you know what you're looking for. Winrod goes to Germany, has counsel with Hitler, comes back. He left there a poor nobody, comes back with all this money, starts the foundation, starts spreading the anti-Semitic protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion all throughout the United States in this platform. Fuller's working with him at the same time. The week after the night of the broken glass, when all of the Germans came in, burn all the buildings of the Jews, the week after this, Amy Semple McPherson puts him in her pulpit in her stead. And think of that. That's horrific, but that's what's happening out there.
Yeah.
At the same time they're out there, Branham's mentor, Roy Davis, is also in Los Angeles building the next wave of the KKK.
Right.
Also out there, you have Chuck Smith, Chuck Smith was probably, I can't say for certain, but he was probably in that meeting with Winrod.
Interesting.
Gordon Lindsay, who helped Branham found the Voice of Healing, started Christ for the Nations, etc. He was a minister trained in that Foursquare Gospel. He became a district head in the district adjacent to North Battleford, where Latter Rain broke out, and he was also involved with this. He toured with Charles Fox Parham, so there's this wide circle of connections that all come back.
Interesting.
And you can't say that there's one trace of either theology or mentology or ideology. I can find elements of each one of these things in Branham's sermons if you know what you're looking for.
Right.
So you've got this massive influx of really, really bad ideas, but also mixed with some really, really good ideas. And you have to break, you kind of have to separate what are they teaching that is just awful but was popular in the time, and what are they teaching that is sound doctrine.
Right.
And if you split that, you can kind of see where everything comes from. Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started, or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the Latter Rain, Charismatic, and other fringe movements into the New Apostolic Reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support.
At a previous episode, we talked about something I had written in one of my books about how, in that same time period in around the 1930s, there was the whole idea that white genes, white genetics were superior to other races. Remember that whole thing? But what was crazy about it is you had people like Helen Keller and Woodrow Wilson and Winston Churchill and all, Charles Lindbergh. Like, you had all these elites around the world who all believed this, right? So the whole concept of racism as we know it now, at that point, they thought they were on the side of science. Like, they were all being intellectuals and, analyzing, right? It's like they weren't, looking at it necessarily with evil in their hearts. They just thought, and of course, Darwin was kind of what they were basing a lot of this on. But question for you is then, if we can't find a specific person, how much did the Depression, the 1930s Depression, impact Pentecostalism? Because it seems to me, as somebody from the outside, I see a lot of these Latter Rain guys seeming to be either young or living during this time, right? And the reason I bring this up is that very often when there are greater social issues, right, where people lose faith in leaders or institutions to save them, they turn to God, right? And they turn to the supernatural, right? It's like, well, we're all in soup lines here, in my family, my mom had to move in with their cousins, right? They had seven in a bed. Potato soup. I've heard all the stories about it, all that. And I keep thinking, well, how much of all that impacted these guys, right? Because they all seem to have come up, that William Branham age group, right? That generation there.
So that's one of the things that fascinates me. And it's not just the Great Depression that impacts all of this. You've got so many different things. You've got the Chicago mob, which I've mentioned, all the weird connections there to Branhamism. But there are things that you don't think about, like the Dust Bowl. The Dust Bowl really doesn't have that much to do with the Great Depression or religion, unless you have an apocalyptic end of days worldview.
You've
got the Great Depression hits. What is the impact of the Great Depression? We have to understand Christian identity. And Christian identity, they believed, this nonsensical thing that the Great Pyramid of Giza was a some sort of a weird prophetic thing by God that was that was spiritual, and they had traced the path or the tunnel down to the King's Chamber, and where they thought that there were imperfections in the descent, they thought that that was some world event. And so they believed that they had mapped out the Great Depression according to the Great Pyramid of Egypt, and that was a bundled part of Christian identity. Charles Fox Parham was a student of Christian identity, as was Sanford, but Gerald Burton Winrod, who I just mentioned, he was big into this. Gordon Lindsay spoke at Christian identity conferences. So that's a big fundamental element. Well, now you have this thing happens that they believed is prophetic in the spiritual world. Then suddenly the Dust Bowl comes in.
Right.
It hits, and oh my gosh.
It's God's judgment.
God's judgment has struck us, man.
Oh, wow. And I could struck, see that.
So that struck right there in the heart of the United States. Well, when Christian identity comes to this is a weird side story, and I'm going on a tangent on purpose. When Christian identity came to a head in the 60s, when the government stepped in, they started investigating all of these riots and the Klan and all of this stuff. Well, it went so deeply underground, and it's weird because it kind of emerged in Arkansas and Missouri. In fact, Gerald Burton Winrod's son, who had a P.O. box right here in my hometown of Jeffersonville, Indiana, where Branham's Branham's Tabernacle is, they had set up the National States Rights Party, which was a racist political party, headquartered here in Jeffersonville for a period of time.
Wow.
Well, he emerges in Arkansas, and he starts to build. In fact, I think it's still there. There was a there's a passion play that you used to go see in Eureka Springs, Arkansas, is where it is.
Yep, I've been to it.
Yeah, Christ of the Ozark. Well, all that exists because of this racist.
People used to come from all over the country because they had live camels and donkeys. Like, it was a whole production. Yeah, I went and saw it in the 1980s. I don't think they do it anymore. Maybe they do. But yeah, I was shocked, you know, because, you know, like you were talking about Eureka, but Branson, like, there's just deep Pentecostal spiritual roots in that southern part of Missouri down there, northern Arkansas.
Oh, yeah.
Ozarks.
It's deep there. There are a lot of Branhamite. In fact, I've been to several of the Branhamite churches in that area.
Of course, most people may not realize this, but the headquarters of the Pentecostal, the Assemblies of God, is in Springfield, which is, again, southern Missouri, right? So there is this interesting regional roots of this whole movement in that area.
Yeah. So it's all connected. And again, you can't say that there's one path of lineage. It's not one single person, but all of these different influences, they just kind of come together. And the reason I went there is because you mentioned Bob Jones came from that area.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Well, what you're describing to me, and tell me if I'm wrong here, but it sounds like Branham's a mutt.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? Because when you look through genealogies and stuff like that, you know, you see some of it, but then there's the pure breeds, right? The guys that come through the colleges and the university, right? And they, you know, they have this lineage that goes back. But what you're describing to me is a guy who's sort of a mutt, like he's a conglomeration of a lot of different influences.
Well, not just a mutt. It's the bad ideas that came from those influences. that's the funny thing. I mean, so I've
bad
studied
genetics.
I've studied all these different movements, and right. So some of these people think that because they're on my website, I'm against them. It's not that I'm against them. That's just a historical connection.
Right.
Some of the groups actually teach some things that are pretty good.
Right.
But they also teach this other thing that's really bad.
Uh-huh.
Well, Branham seemed to hone in on whatever was the bad thing and say, this is of God. And it might be mysticism. Right. It might be spiritualism. Whatever it is, he would pick and choose the worst of the worst of the worst, combine it together and say, I know the mystery of what God kept secret from you.
Well, what's fascinating to me, right, is that on the evangelical side of the equation, you know, the fundamentalist, your stature is your ability dissect the Word of God, right? You're Greek and you're Hebrew, right? It's all focused on theology, right? And so you go, you know, you go to college and then you go to, you know, to a theology school and you get trained in a certain worldview of theology and you come out and you're a minister, right? On the Pentecostal side of the equation, it's like you have this spiritual gift, or are you this perception that you have a spiritual gift that makes you elite or different from everyone else, and then therefore whatever theology you say is of God, right? It's like two completely different paradigms, you know what I mean? And so it's like random, you know, one of the things that, you know, as an outsider, I'm looking at and I'm like, wow, it's like just like the guys that I saw here. It's like everybody's drooling over them because they got a word of knowledge or, you know, they have a prophecy. And then because of that, now we're all going to listening to their theology and their worldviews, right? And people just accept it, right? And that's where I think what you're talking about, where things really get off the rails, is they don't really go back to their Bibles, go back to look at the Word of God and actually look at what's in there and go, does this in any way reflect the teachings of the apostles and the founding fathers of our faith, right? It's like we're way over here, but they don't think about it like that, right? And so that's where, you know, it's not that evangelicals haven't had their problems as well, but the Pentecostal world is just, it's like this, to me, it's just like this massive amount of all these figures. You know what I mean? It's like all of these figures that you know, that all have these, you know, public personas. And they're all got a lot of opinions that people are taking as the Word of God. Because the man of God says it, right? To the extreme of what we were talking about earlier with Jim Jones, that people are going to drink the Kool-Aid because the guy is, you know, knows what he's talking about.
Yeah, the funny part is, so we're close enough to this that there'll be people listening who can get it, what I'm trying to say. There was a period of time whenever people looked at the Mayan calendar and thought the world is going to end. You right. probably remember this. This wasn't that long ago. Right?
They made a movie about it.
Yeah, exactly. So there are people that get so caught up in the mystery of when things
the numbers.
Are going, the numerologies, the mystery of when this world is going to be no more. That's fascinating to people. Well, the fascination before the Mayan calendar was actually the Great Pyramid of Giza. Because they had mapped this out and they thought they had put a timeline of dates and they had aligned it to World War I, World War II, trivial wars around the globe, the Great Depression. What's interesting is it's mostly centered in the United States, but all of these different life events, and then it ends. Right. So they thought this was a calendar predicting the end of the world. What I have come to understand, if I were to map it to a single... You can't map it to a person, but map it to an ideology and then think through that just a bit. So Gordon Lindsay is speaking at the Anglo-Saxon Federation, which is one of the key hubs of the Christian identity doctrine. The ones that are spreading the anti-Semitic texts, were, you know, Henry Ford was actually backing a lot of that. I don't know if you knew that. So you've got the wealthy and elite thinking, we have a roadmap to the end of days. What do we do? And Gordon Lindsay's preaching it. Well, Gerald Winrod is also preaching it. So you've got the fundamentalists joining with the Pentecostals. You can also find, as I mentioned, Frank Sanford's teaching it, John Dowie's teaching it. All of these different streams that I'm talking about, they all have one thing in common, and that's Christian identity. Mm-hmm. They each have different doctrines and different frameworks of theology. But at the core root of their theology is the idea that, A, the world is about to end. B, we have a secret to know the map of when this world is going to end.
Right.
And it spins off all of these doomsday predictions. Sanford had a doomsday prediction, and they all ran to the rooftops and said, today's it. We're going to go up.
Right.
And then they didn't.
Well, but that concept of secret knowledge is not even unique to Pentecost, right? Kabbalah in Judaism is the same way. Like, you know, we have the knowledge, right? Or the Gnostics, right? We have this secret knowledge. It seems to be a human, you know, trait. We all kind of want to well, not all, but I'm just saying there's always this group of people that want to position themselves as, I know what you don't. I always laugh at them. I go, you know what? I love archaeology and anthropology, and we can't even figure out the past. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you think you're going to predict the future? And it's like you know how many times I've heard somebody go, wow, this latest discovery changes our whole concept, or it changes our whole timeline, or yeah. It changes our whole impression of this civilization or these creatures. And it's like, that's the past. You know what I mean? We can't even get that right. And so it's like when I hear all these people thinking they got the secret knowledge of the future, I'm like, really?
So now let's expand that a bit, the node of Christian identity and Pentecostalism. And I think you'll get what I'm trying to say, because now I'm gonna bring it full circle, okay, all the way back. And it's taking this whole podcast to do it.
Bring it home.
All the way back to KCF, right? So at Frank Sanford School in Maine, uh-huh, one of the Christian identity leaders that he is promoting is Cal Totten. Cal Totten was a military leader. He was the professor of military science and tactics at Yale University, and one of the strongest proponents of Christian identity. So he's bringing in Christian identity, which, for anybody who doesn't know, and I should have said this at the beginning of the podcast, it's the idea that the people of the British Isles and the United States are the lost 10 tribes of Israel, mm-hmm, and we can determine which ones are and aren't by the skin color. Mm-hmm. And the Jews are that you see today, they're the bad guys. We're the real Jews.
Right.
So picture a military leader who's teaching this, who's teaching a militant form of Christianity in the Pentecostal circles that he's working with. What develops from this is the idea of Joel's army. Mm-hmm. We need a military. This is the end of days. We have a roadmap to the end of days. The battle's coming, guys. Let's get ready for the end of days battle. We need an army. And that's really where, you can trace the Joel's army elements of it long before Latter Rain, but it came to this weird head because of Christian identity's mixture with Pentecostalism.
Interesting. Huh.
Fast forward to Bob Jones, Paul Kane, they're teaching the same thing, and they think they're teaching it like it's a new thing.
Right.
But it really came out of that theology.
Interesting. Yeah, because if you go back to the actual foundations of the church, right, in 100 AD, there was even a big discussion and dialogue whether Christians should even serve in the Roman army, right? I mean, there was a huge collision, honestly, about it, right? Because a lot of the followers of Jesus felt like the whole concept of a militant church was way off the reservation. Like, that was the opposite. Jesus was a bringer of peace, right? He was somebody that crossed ethnic and religious boundaries, right? He was somebody that was always trying to bring people together. And so the whole idea of killing another human, like, that was just that debate went on for centuries, right? And so that's interesting because, here now it's like, of course,
Yeah.
But, a couple thousand years ago, it wasn't enough, of course. It was a major struggle, right? But, I mean, you see it even in today's politics, right? It's that same concept, It's not much different than old Constantine and his sword, right? It's, if you go back and look in the Middle Ages, it was convert or die by the sword, right? To your point, this has been going on for, way before Joel's army.
Another thing, so you mentioned Gnosticism. Uh-huh. So now that I've zoomed in and I've showed you that map, now let's explode it up a little bit more in a different way. Okay. I mentioned the pyramid, I mentioned the doomsday themes. Now think through this. Whenever they were spreading Christian identity at these conferences, they would bring in these scaled pyramids,
Really?
Pull it apart. Yeah, it's weird, man. They were actually taking these into churches, showing pyramids in churches. So they had these.
So it was a pyramid scheme.
It was a pyramid scheme of pyramids, right? So they would bring in these guys who had these numbskull ideas of how this map worked. Well, it wasn't just the pyramid. There was another thing. Because if you understand how the pyramid works and understand the earth and its axis, mm-hmm. the pyramid is pointing straight up to, what is it, Orion's belt, I think, or whatever. Mm-hmm. So some guy came up with the cockamamie notion that, well, if the pyramid is a roadmap of our end of days and it's pointing up to a sign in the zodiac, well, the zodiac must also be a roadmap of sorts. What is it? And they started to study the zodiac, and that's why you can find Branham, he says very openly, the first Bible was the zodiac, the second mm-hmm. was the pyramids, the third one is our King James. He's saying this because of Christian identity. So once that started to spread, now you've got all of these ministers in Christian fundamentalism and Pentecostalism who are now trying to figure out, well, what does that mean? And think of how people do, these ministers, when they get the book of Revelation, it's all symbolic, and they think that they've got it all figured out, and they come up with these numbskull ideas. Well, now think what they would do if you unleash those types of people onto the zodiac. They're going to find all the mysticism, all the spiritualism, all of these other different Gnosticism, all of these things. So it all comes into the movement. And that's why whenever a historian looks through the doctrine, they say, oh, well, that came from Gnosticism. Mm. It did, but it actually is a result of Christian identity.
Interesting. Well, I know our time is short, but if I, from my perspective, I'll step back and share where my heart is in listening to you and all this. It's been my observation, having attended many of the meetings run by ministers, exactly what you're describing, guys who think they have insight, right? They've got the secret knowledge. The thing that I was always struck by while I was sitting in those meetings is pride. You know, I would sit there and it was like this need. I mean, it almost, in some ways, it could be inverted pride, which is this desperate feeling of insecurity that somebody has. And so therefore, you know, I'm going to project now that I have this inside thing, right? This need to separate myself from the rest of you because I'm special. And, you know, I ended up realizing that my best friend was this guy, right? Mike. It was like he had this need, but it's all driven by ego, right? All driven by this need to be stood out from everyone else, right? To be separate from everyone else, to be at a different spiritual plane than everyone else. Now, here's why I think this is so insidious. Because it all sounds so good. Like when you're sitting there, it tickles your ears, right? It's like, ooh, I want to have the secret knowledge too. But you know what it distracts us from? The very essence of Christianity, which is, do you love your neighbor? Right? It's like somehow we get so caught up in all these ancillary sort of things that make us all feel better about ourselves because we all have the secret knowledge. And we forget to focus on what is the very essence of Christianity is, do I love my neighbor? Do I love my wife? Do I love my kids? What am I doing? Am I touching the poor? Right? Well, you know what? Those things all take humility. Right? Because Jesus says something, you know, that just has always just pierced me. There's no greater love than to lay your life down for someone else. Like, there's no greater love than that. Like, that's the top. But that's the ultimate humility, right? And so I sometimes wonder, it's like, I mean, I don't know, but it's almost like in the con game, you know, the way that pickpockets work is they distract your eyesight over to something over here, oh, shiny, while they're down in your pocket pulling your wallet out, right? And because you're so focused on this cool thing that you're not paying attention to the fact that the guy just took your wallet out of you, right? I mean, that's how they work. And it's sometimes, I feel like in the church world, it's the same way. We're over here, like, all enamored by, oh, shiny. Or we're missing the kind of the point of all this, right? And so that's where, you know, I'm fascinated by everything you've said. But then I'm starting to look at it and go, but I don't think this is a good thing. Like, I think this is God us way, like, it's distracted us from our mission. right? It's like they've created almost a false god, right? It's like this idol of secret knowledge, right? And we all feel good because I'm part of the cult of secret knowledge. And we miss the point.
Absolutely. You know, and to bring it home, kind of like you are, when they brought in spiritualism, that's really what explains all of the weird nastiness that you see, the grave soaking, Branham's communication with the dead, all of these different things. It all comes from spiritualism, but it comes from exactly what you said. It is a prideful mentality. You want to know the future, because if I know the future, think of all the things that I can do with the future. And I'm going to anger half the crowd who's listening, I know, because when I say this, I'm a big fan of Stephen King books and books in that genre. Mm-hmm. And there's a one theme that I think people miss how important that theme is, and you can get it from almost any books in that genre. There's this theme where if you know the future, you get so caught up in it that you're not paying attention to the current, and it actually is to your own destruction.
Yeah, that's right.
There's several themes like this, right? And that comes directly, I know King probably didn't write it from the words of Jesus, but look at what Jesus said in Matthew 6, I think it is. Don't worry about tomorrow, because tomorrow will take care of itself. Today has its own troubles. Right. Worry about the things of today. In other words, don't be caught up trying to predict futures and look at all of this stuff. Don't be building pyramids, models, and taking them to churches so you can see when the end of days. People get so caught up in that, and they try to find the end of days, and they totally forget here in the now, we're living, and we need to live the best we can now. We don't need to worry about what's happening in the future.
Well, I think a word picture that we all have experienced is that we're looking over here, and we trip over. Have you ever done that? Like you're going downstairs, and you're looking at somebody thing over there, and you like completely miss the stair. Or I've done this one where I hit the last stair, and I'm so focused on something that I don't realize that I hit the ground. You know what I mean? And you're like, oh my God, you know, it takes you off balance. And I think there's a word picture here that we get, you know, it's like, hey, why don't you pay attention to where you're walking right now? Right? We get in trouble when we're not paying attention. We're distracted by that thing over there, right? It gets us into trouble. We hurt ourselves. We can even hurt others, right? I mean, this is kind of a wild example, but that's the whole point of not texting and driving, right? Yeah. It's like, you know, you can kill somebody. Like, focus on what's in front of you, right? And that's where I think why this is so insidious, what you're talking about. Anyways, thank you so much. You're such a wealth of knowledge on all this. I really enjoy having these conversations with you, because it just kind of unpacks a lot of the behind the scenes. How do we get here? It's like, you know, I think for most people, because they're not church historians, they don't have time to drill down. Somebody with your with your knowledge, experience, and all the research you've done, it's really helpful for people to sort of get I don't know if they have these anymore, but I call them the Cliff Notes version, right? The summary version of how did we get here? Like, you know, there's all these things happening right now. Well, how did we get here? Like, why is this happening? So we're in a state right now. I don't know where it's going to go, but there's a lot of change coming.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for doing this. This has been crazy fun, and I've only skimmed the surface, man.
If you want, I know. To dig deeper, we have some, you know, B, C, and D sessions we can do. But yes, exactly.
Well, if you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org. For more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR. And for more about Mike Bickle, IHOP KC, and the Kansas City Prophets, you can read Some Said They Blundered, Breaking My Decades of Silence on Mike Bickle, the Kansas City Prophets, and the International House of Prayer.